You're listening to Radio Orbit with Mike Hagen on KOPN 89.5 FM.
Dr. Eric Feigl-Ding is an epidemiologist, a health economist, and nutrition scientist at the Harvard Chan School of Public Health. His work focuses on the intersection of public health and public policy. He has expertise in systematic reviews, public health program design, and policy implementation. As a childhood cancer survivor, Dr. Ding has been a longtime cancer prevention advocate and fundraiser. He founded Toxin Alert as the first geosocial network and public alert system for drinking water toxic contamination, as featured in Wired magazine. He's published in leading journals, including the New England Journal of Medicine, the Journal of American Medical Association, Lancet, and Health Policy. He has over 150 publications that have received over 62,000 citations, ranking among the top 1% of all scientists cited worldwide in 2018. He graduated from the Johns Hopkins University with honors and completed his dual doctorate in epidemiology and nutrition as the youngest graduate in Harvard history of the dual program. He's been teaching there for over 15 years. It's a pleasure and a privilege. Welcome to the show, Doctor. Thank you for taking the time to talk with us. I wish it was under less concerning conditions.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Thank you very much. Okay, good. I could have gone on and on about your background. You've obviously been doing a whole lot of things for a long time. I wanted the listeners to get a good feel, though, for some of your qualifications. If you'd like to give anything else that might be relevant with regard to the topic of our conversation tonight, which is going to be the 2019 nCoV coronavirus that is causing so much concern as of late. But maybe just to start a little bit more about yourself, if that would help.
Yeah, I think I've been studying epidemiology for many years, not just infectious disease epidemiology, but, you know, like lead drinking water poisoning after the Flint crisis, as well as a lot of the epidemics related to diabetes and obesity and cancer. I would say that this is one of the most unusual epidemics in terms of public health scale and concern that's kind of shaken the world market. And so I think this is a preeminent public health emergency of our times. And I think everyone should be paying attention to this, because this is something that is going to come to our shores, if not already here. And I think this will disrupt many, many things in our lives for the coming year.
Okay. Yeah, I'm sure many people are aware that a very serious situation has been developing in Asia, primarily China, with the outbreak of this particular infectious disease. Could we start maybe with your current assessment of the situation, and then maybe we can get into some of the details?
Yeah, I think what people have to realize is this thing's been brewing in China for quite a while, since early December at least. And it was kind of ignored for the first month. And, you know, people woke up to it in early January. But it's caused so much economic meltdown in China. And the case numbers just continue to rise in many ways. But more concern now is that the lockdown in China has kind of failed. Like, it's succeeded in slowing the epidemic, but it's failed to contain it within China. And now you see it in South Korea, Southeast Asia, Japan, now the Middle East, as well as an epidemic in Europe. And just for perspective, people ask, well, how does it compare to the common flu or the SARS? And the common seasonal flu has a reproductive number of about 1.3, which means for every infected person, that person infects 1.3 more, which is just a little bit more. It's a slow growth rate. But for this virus, it has a reproductive number of 2 to 4, depending on the situation. And that means for every infected person, they infect 2 more to 4 more. And that will just lead to exponential growth. And the other difference is we don't have a vaccine for this yet. No one has any immunity because it's a brand new virus.
How is that determined, the R0 factor or the spreadability factor that you mentioned?
Right. That is derived from the early modeling of the cases. And there's different ways to derive it, but the best estimates are around 2.6, 2.9, based on when people showed symptoms and how soon the next person was infected, it requires a small epidemiologic investigation. So that is that's how we kind of know it. But we also can see in certain populations it's even higher than that. So I think it's realistic that this is at least double the spread in terms of transmission reproductive number as the common flu.
Mm-hmm.
And again, to compare to SARS, for example, SARS, it took about 9 months to have 800 deaths. We hit that in the first 6 weeks. Now we're at about 2,500 deaths, 2,600 deaths. So we have already almost over tripled the number of deaths in less than a quarter of the time as SARS.
Hmm.
So this epidemic is such a unique kind of global event right now, because it's now as local community-driven transmission, as in it's not related to China travel whatsoever in so many countries.
Okay. There are a number of people that are asking about the true numbers in China, if we're getting legitimate information. And I would probably add the WHO and the CDC, et cetera. How confident should we be in the numbers and in general, the information that we're getting from these organizations, knowing that they have sort of conflicted interests, if you know what I mean?
Right. Well, there's a lot of discussion about the underdiagnosis in China. And a lot of experts put it at anywhere between 10x to 20x underdiagnosis. And then the true cases are probably 10x higher. But what basically China's been doing is they've been kind of ignoring the mild cases and mostly just testing the more severe ones.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where a lot of the numbers for China are. And their testing capacity is only 6,000 test runs per day in Hubei province, which is a province containing Wuhan.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they've been maxed out in terms of that testing capacity. So, hence they were only testing more severe and ignoring the mild. They're doing what they can do. I think the trend line is that it is slowing in China, but at the same time, are we capturing everyone? Because the other unique thing, the reason it spreads faster than SARS, it seems, is that unlike SARS, where until you develop symptoms, that means until you end your incubation period in your body, it didn't spread for SARS. You're not contagious. But for this virus, it seems that even when you have not developed symptoms, before you even know you have the virus, feel sick, you could already start transmitting it.
Hmm.
And that is what makes containment so much more difficult for this virus than others.
Right. Wow. Okay. There is not a countermeasure for that as of now, right? There's not a vaccine or a medicine that is effective as
not
far
yet.
As we know? Okay.
Right. So a world record would be a vaccine within 1 year, and that's what we're trying to shoot for.
Okay.
They're developing a few vaccine candidates, and they're going to put them through phase one, which takes 3 months, and phase two, which takes 3 months. And then ramp up worldwide production will take another 2 or 3 months.
Right.
So by the time we see a vaccine, it'll be a year from now.
Okay.
There are a few antiviral drugs. They were originally invented for HIV because this is also an RNA virus.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're testing them right now. Remdesivir is one of them. But again, these trials will take more time. But because they're already pre-developed for another disease, we can skip to phase two. So that drug will finish its clinical testing, these trials, and most of these trials are going on in China, by the way, these heroic randomized trials and researchers. That will probably take 6 to 9 months before we know for sure. But we're hopeful. Maybe we could get earlier results, preliminary results.
Okay.
But until then, we don't have anything to slow it other than public health hygiene and social distancing measures.
Yeah. What about test kits? What's really required in order to test for this thing? And do people have the capacity to really test as much as they need to?
Yeah. So the testing requires reagents, these certain chemicals, plus these PCR probes, these primers, basically that will stick. They are well designed to stick to these virus particles so that it can be amplified in a PCR, polymerase chain reaction test. Mm. But it's doable, but it's a bit intensive in terms of labor. Hence, there's a certain capacity issue. But Korea has, for example, has done an amazing job. Korea is the size of Maine, for example, but has a population of California, Oregon, Washington. Mm. But they've done 32,000 tests in just a matter of a week or two, while the U.S. altogether has done only 500. And this is why it's a little concerning for U.S. because what happened was CDC was supposed to have sent these testing kits to all these labs across the country so that they could do their own tests themselves. Mm-hmm. But these kits failed.
Yes, I read something about that.
Recalled by the CDC.
Yeah, yeah.
And so right now, all the tests are only done at three states and plus CDC headquarters in Atlanta, which creates a huge bottleneck. And
that's why
they haven't expanded the criteria. Like right now, the criteria is, if you had direct contact with one of the existing 15 cases, plus if you would travel to Wuhan. But that's really restrictive because this virus is everywhere now, not just Wuhan, but also Greater China, all these East Asia, Middle East, Italy. So I think this criteria needs to be urgently updated. But I think there's this bottleneck because they're of the lab capacity with these faulty kits that they're trying to fix.
Wow. All right. Do we know anything about susceptibility? Are some people more susceptible than others? Is there anything that makes a person perhaps more susceptible?
A lot of people are saying age, but I'm looking across the board and it seems like in terms of being infected, almost anyone's at risk of being infected.
Okay.
Old and young, men or women. I think the main susceptibility is the risk of dying. Obviously, there is a higher risk if you have comorbidities.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're a little bit older.
Mm-hmm.
And the other interesting thing is they found, and this is from a small study, there's a higher mortality case fatality ratio among men than among women, about like 1 to 2%. So we don't know if it's by chance. In the study, it was significant, but we have to follow up on that. But it seems men do die a little bit more than women from this for some reason. And, other people say, well, young people die. And my answer is, well, first of all, oftentimes more young people are turned away with mild disease. But I want to point out, like, for example, there's 10 healthcare workers in China who died. And more than half of them are pretty young. There's a 34-year-old, Dr. Li, the whistleblower who passed away.
Mm-hmm.
Two 29-year-old doctors and another 42-year-old doctor who passed away. Just in this week alone.
Wow.
So these are pretty young people in their prime and they're healthcare workers who would have gotten the best treatment possible, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yet they still died. So I think no one's really, really safe, but luckily the mortality, we think the case fatality ratio is about 1 to 2%. And there's an uncertainty because there's delay in diagnosis resolution. Either you recover or you die. Not every case is resolved yet. And there's an underdiagnosis issue. So so they're ballparking 1 to 2%. But for comparison, the flu is around 0.1%.
Wow.
So even 1 to 2%, it means it's 10x to 20x higher mortality than the flu. And remember, as we've mentioned before, it spreads faster than flu.
Right, right.
So this is where the concern is with this virus.
Okay. Wow. Okay. I read an article that was questioning whether it was possible to transmit the disease vertically from mother to child, like HIV. Does that make any sense, or have you heard anything about that?
I think it's possible. There's very limited data. I saw one study that said, did pregnant mothers have any adverse outcomes, pregnancy outcomes? And in the limited handful of cases, there were only less than 10, but this is a couple of weeks ago, there were no adverse outcomes among the pregnant women. So this is not like Zika.
Mm.
Zika, if you recall, created this brain damage in babies,
yes,
right?
Yes.
This is not one of those. It's a very different kind of virus because, many women, when they're pregnant, get the flu and it doesn't cause some apocalyptic thing. But in the limited data so far, it doesn't seem to be a major issue.
Okay. All right. Could you do perhaps sort of a compare and contrast between some of these other pathogens that we've seen in the past? You mentioned SARS. We've also had MERS. We've had Ebola, swine flu, H1N1, yeah, bird flu. We've had all of these different things over the years. Because, see, I think a lot of people are, they feel like it's the crying of wolf, you know, and they've heard it so many times before, and now they think, oh, it's just another, what's the new thing these days? Yeah. Nothing burger, right?
Yeah. So I think, you know, first of all, you've heard of all of them, but most of them have not really hit America that hard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Ebola is obviously a very unique hemorrhagic fever with a 50% mortality, but that's mostly been confined to Africa. And Ebola, again, the other thing is Ebola kills very quickly in certain ways that limits how much it can spread.
Right.
And again, it's not endemic to anywhere outside of Africa. So, again, high mortality, but very limited spread. And SARS has, for example, a 10% case fatality ratio, as in 1 in 10 people died, so which is much higher than this one. But, again, it doesn't spread as far and fast as this one, it seems. MERS had, about 20-30% mortality, but again, it was very limited outbreak. And, you know, the other swine flu ones, they were an epidemic, but, you know, not to the extent that this one has been.
Mm-hmm.
This one has been much faster. The asymptomatic transmission seems much stronger, and the reproductive number seems pretty high. And again, all those other ones were contained pretty much before the vaccine arrived. But all signs are indicating that this virus is going to keep going and keep chugging along,
mm-hmm,
until we have these really strong countermeasures.
Right.
Because I think this is not a cry wolf thing. This is why I've tried to preface earlier that I've seen many outbreaks. Every once in a while, we have a TB outbreak too.
Mm-hmm.
But this is one of those viruses that I think will shake the world a little bit. Mortality is limited, but if you have a high denominator of number of people infected, even with mild and asymptomatic transmission as well, I think more of the world will be touched by this. And there's some estimates that, you know, by some other Harvard colleagues, that 40 to 60% of the world will be infected by 1 year's end.
Wow.
So that's a pretty large number.
Yeah.
And I really hope that the mortality drops by then, that we will have, you know, more of these antiviral drugs that can slow down the transmission and disease progression.
Okay.
But it seems like this case is also very unique. Like just today, WHO says people with mild infections have it for about 2 weeks. People with severe have it for 3 to 6 weeks. And that's worrisome, because even if the mortality is low, if a huge number of them, anywhere from 15 to 20%, have a severe case, 3 to 6 weeks of a severe case, which severe meaning they need hospitalization most likely, I don't think any hospital system in the world can handle that.
Can handle
and, you
the
know,
load.
Even China's
yeah.
trained, and they yeah. know how to build hospitals in 10 days,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think any other country can. So that is the main worry, that the high disease duration will basically crush the healthcare system. And when that happens, many other spillover indirect effects, you know, treatment for cancers, treatments for any other diseases will also be slowed down. It will just jam up the healthcare system and really cause a mess.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be potentially doing similar things to the economic systems as well of the whole planet, I think. Before we get there, though, we may or may not talk about that, but I have a question here from a listener about asking if I could ask you about the accuracy of the test for the new coronavirus and how long it takes to get test results.
Yeah, the accuracy is a problem because the... The primers, I think, they were designed just as a quick test. You know, even the Chinese Academy of Science has admitted that the test is only 30 to 50% accurate,
Oh, yeah.
Meaning we're missing a lot of positive cases, there's a lot of false negatives. Mm. And that's actually the main problem. Like, false positives don't usually happen with these kind of tests. You either get it, test positive or not. But the false negative, it becomes a problem because it's partly a lab issue, but it's partly also the nature of the disease, that people sometimes shed viruses late in the disease course. And also, for example, if you look at the first U.S. Washington State case, really well documented in the New England Journal of Medicine, he tested positive on his nasal swab every day. They took serial measurements every day when he was hospitalized.
Okay.
But if you tested his blood, there were some days that it wasn't positive. It came out negative when he tested all these other things.
Wow.
And even on the final day where his viral load was the highest, his mouth, test of his mouth yielded negative. And so there seems to be a lot of the shedding of viruses in different pathways, and which causes a lot of weird testing phenomena. Like, the tests are relatively fast, but the issue is it capturing a true negative? And so if someone tests negative, should you let them out into the wild?
Mm.
And what happened, for example, with a few days ago, these cruise ship passengers, these Americans, were being repatriated by the State Department.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the cruise ship. Yeah.
Yeah. They tested negative. And then, so the positive ones were kept in the Japanese hospital. The negative ones, they were going to fly home. But just as they were boarding the plane, a follow-up test found 14 of them to be positive. I mean, they were already, on the bus, on the tarmac, on the plane. And hence, the CDC, State Department kerfuffle of should we let them on or not. I was on CNN about this the other day, but basically, it's tricky because you were negative, and then you test positive. And then what do you do? And should you release someone as recovered if they test negative once?
Or should
you require multiple negative tests? It becomes a very tricky issue, and that is also hampers global containment of this virus.
Mm. I think I'd like to ask maybe about human rights issues and the effects of such massive quarantines and lockdowns. I'm sure you'd agree it's pretty much unprecedented what we've seen as far as what's happening in China. But I'd also like to ask you about, considering the long incubation, the crazy ability to transmit something without a cure, how likely is it that a quarantine would actually be effective?
I think quarantine would definitely slow down.
Mm-hmm.
And quarantines are only as effective as you keep them quarantined for, to make sure that this person is a truly negative case. So if someone returns from China or abroad anywhere, and suppose you quarantine them, the purpose of quarantine is to make sure that if they have the virus, that, we will see it and make sure they don't spread it before the quarantine period is up. But if they show no symptoms, then you kind of trust that they're okay and you release them into the wild. But the problem is currently the 14-day quarantine, there's some people who say it's too short because the incubation time is around 5 to 7 days. But that's just the average, which means half our people are shorter, half our people have longer time.
Mm-hmm.
And in order for quarantine to work, you have to make sure it's long enough to snuff out all the extreme people in the tail.
Right.
Right. For those who have a little bit longer, 10 to 12 days, or maybe pushing 14 days, that your 14 days is long enough to capture that by the time you release them, they are truly negative. And so the question is, is that long enough? And there's been a few case reports that it's not. There's 7-day case reports, and that's the uncertain thing. Are these just extreme examples, flukes, or is that normal? And if so, should we extend the quarantine to 3 weeks, maybe?
Yeah, yeah. All right, couple more for you here, all right? Now that we're seeing cases in Italy, Iran, South Korea, Japan, the numbers coming out of those places, do we know anything about whether they corroborate what the Chinese are telling us? I'm wondering if we can kind of cross-reference for accuracy, you know what I mean? In other words, would things be happening as quickly as they are in Italy if the Chinese were telling us the truth, et cetera?
There's an apples and orange thing going on because Korea is just testing anyone and everyone with any cough or fever.
Mm-hmm.
They're like testing anyone with any symptom. Like that's why they're getting so aggressive. 30,000 tests.
Right.
You can test it. Let's test them. So Korea has a high case count. Korea has the highest case count outside China, but Korea also has the most mildest. Many are asymptomatic, many are mild.
Mm-hmm.
Contrast that with Iran. The first two cases in Iran were not just cases. They were deaths.
Yeah, yeah.
They were death cases immediately, which means that, you know, given what we know, 2 weeks for a mild, 3 to 6 weeks for severe, and these are severes, that the fact that the first two cases were deaths means that it's already been going through the population unchecked for 3 to 6 weeks.
Wow, wow.
And that's really worrisome because no one's been picking it up.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, there was one case of a woman who flew back from Iran to British Columbia, Vancouver, and she had all the symptoms. There were Canada doesn't require testing for someone who flew not from China, but this ER doctor was pretty astute and said, you know, you have all the symptoms, you've been traveling, let's just test you. He did it anyways against, you know, requirements,
mm-hmm.
and she tested positive, which only further confirmed that, you know, A, it's already in Iran and leading Iran, and since over the weekend it's infected five other Middle Eastern countries in the area, and that our current protocol of Wuhan only or even China only is grossly inadequate. So to answer your question, look, South Korea has very different testing approach.
Mm-hmm.
They're testing everyone and anyone. China is testing only the more severe ones. Mild ones, please stay home. We don't have capacity for you. And Iran is basically like finding out after the fact that the first two cases died.
Wow.
So I think there's a lot of apples and oranges. You can't compare them yet.
Okay. What about the viability of the virus on objects, inanimate objects, or on surfaces, something like that?
Yeah.
I know there's some concern with regard to just the movement of so much material goods and things between China and the rest of the world. Obviously, can you imagine, Eric, the conversations being had at like Amazon and Alibaba and places like that? My gosh.
Right. Right. Yeah, there's Alibaba factories in central China that are really affected, as well as Foxconn, Apple factories, iPhone. So the inanimate, we don't have good research on it yet, but knowing what we know about previous coronaviruses, it's about 7 days-ish, plus or minus, depending on temperature and humidity. But yeah, unless you disinfect, which, you know, bleach disinfectant, many peroxides will disinfect and kill them pretty quickly. But unless you disinfect, they could survive for a long time, you know, a week. So for cargo containers, I think we're probably okay because these ships travel for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
But I think air transport, air cargo, these overnight shipping kind of things.
Oh, yeah.
It poses a challenge because unless you disinfect everything, they could survive. So, you know, we don't have direct research on this yet. It's worrisome in that sense. So should we shine a UV light on all incoming cargo? Maybe. We don't have protocols for these.
Yeah, yeah. You know, as we're talking, I was thinking about another troublesome aspect is the fact that it's hard to tell the difference from the symptoms. In other words, if somebody has Ebola, you know it. If somebody has COV or they have the flu, I guess for the average person, it's hard to tell the diff.
Yeah, exactly. It is the middle of cold and flu season, and there are other coronaviruses floating around that cause the common cold.
Mm-hmm.
There's other cause viruses that cause common cold, too.
Yes.
The family. But yeah, it's very difficult to differentiate. I think viral pneumonia is, you know, in flu, the pneumonia is not as severe as this.
Hmm.
So if you have a very severe pneumonia, it will, but there's many other viruses. There's probably five other viruses that cause viral pneumonia. It's hard to really tell. So the US CDC flu surveillance system, well, assuming that they get their kits working, was supposed to, as they announced more than 12 days ago, test anyone and everyone who tested negative for flu. Like if your sample in these flu labs, which are these monitoring systems, if they test negative for flu, they were supposed to test them for coronavirus, for this new novel coronavirus.
Mm.
But a again, it's been kind of frozen. So that's kind of like the passive sampling system, but it is tricky. And the other thing is, right now, there's a stigma, right, that if someone tests positive, do they become a pariah?
Yeah.
Because, you know, these debates are already showing up around schools. Someone just traveled and came back from overseas in China. Should they let their kids attend school?
Yeah.
This issue is already cropping up. And secondly, is it that, you know, if there's a lot of out-of-pocket costs for going to the doctor to get tested, and if the U.S. government doesn't cover it, are we only going to basically pick up those who can afford to go get tested?
Yeah.
Right? And then if that happens, there will be a lot of people who will just not be tested, especially hourly workers. Because if they get tested and they have to get quarantined for 14 days, that means they don't have income for 14 days. So there's a disincentive to get tested as well that potentially could set in that could only exacerbate this epidemic. So it's very worrisome.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I was just looking at the sort of economic outlook, and I read a story earlier today that in February, the auto sales in China overall were down 92% from the previous year. And I'm sort of in the auto industry here on the manufacturing side on another job that I have, and there are certainly going to be supply chain issues. I'm not sure how it's going to unfold, but it's pretty serious, I think, Eric.
Yeah, auto is definitely, obviously, auto is just one index.
But
it's one of those, it's not an immediate demand product, but I think the sales and businesses of almost everything will go down a lot, other than certain things like masks, suits, and toilet paper. But I think the global demand, this is why the stock market started crashing today, because it's this, markets work if there's a combination of production as well as demand and marginal propensity to consume, as we say in economics. Are people going to be really tight with their wallet in a fear kind of situation, or are they going to be very spendthrift when the economy is good?
Yeah.
And I think what happens is when there's global fear of anything, especially panic, people panic buy certain things, which causes huge shortages and supply issues, but also they get really tight with their wallets. And I'm really worried about that.
It's something else, and I guess we just have to watch and pay attention and do the best we can. I sure appreciate everything that you've been doing, Eric. You've been extremely steadfast in your work and providing information for people. I'll mention this a couple of times, but if people would like to get in touch with you or follow your work, what's the best way to do that? I'm guessing your Twitter account.
Yeah, my Twitter's I have the most updates. I have like 10 or 20 updates a day. It's at Dr. Eric Ng, so feel free to contact me there. Or send me a direct message.
Very good. That's at Dr. and it's DR, not the word doctor spelled, but at Dr. Eric Ding. And you'll be able to link to his Twitter from my site from here on out. You know, I'm going to throw one at you from left field, no pun intended, because I want to end on a more positive note. When I was looking at your bio, I saw something about baseball, and I'm a huge baseball fan, and my son actually plays high school ball here, and we're looking for a college for him and all this stuff. But anyway, I was stunned when I saw that you were involved in this big study that involved over 500,000 players and all kinds of data. Could you please tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah. It was a hobby, analyze the baseball data. But, you know, there's a lot of people who analyze baseball data to, you know, see who will be best in their fantasy baseball league. But what we did was we linked every single Major League Baseball player with their mortality data. And, you know, obviously more recent players have not died, but a lot of Major League players from 1870s, when the Major Leagues were started, on have died. So we were analyzing, does being a bigger player, like a higher body mass index player, like think Babe Ruth, have higher mortality? Because the argument in body mass index is, well, if you're an athlete, it's okay. It's all muscle. It's okay to have a high BMI. BMI doesn't count for muscle. And that was a hand-waving statement a lot of people said. So kind of linked, think about, well, what sport can we really analyze? Basketball and football, both pretty young sports. But baseball, you could. and we found that higher BMI, even in the moderate 25 to 27 range, yielded higher mortality among these baseball players, you know, at their debut. So this is at their peak. And so some people said was, well, is this only a kind of like a big Babe Ruth kind of effect? Is this true for everything? Or, and so we analyzed it, even among players with high stolen bases, which are the true sprinters, right? Even among the sprinting stolen base players, this effect still held. So wow. It kind of indicated that you know, this effect is true, regardless if you're a stolen base sprinter or you're a designated hitter, like Barry Bonds, who has not died. I just want to point out. But it just shows that, you know, we wanted to analyze this, and baseball was like the perfect data set to analyze. And if also you hit a lot of home runs and you're also obese, you actually have even more higher risk of death. But that's a different story.
Very interesting. All right. Well, I appreciate you sharing that with me. Let me say thank you again, Dr. Ding. I sure appreciate what you're doing. It's very important work. And I hope we can stay in touch and maybe we can get some updates down the road if necessary. Okay.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Take care. Bye. That was earlier today. I spoke with Dr. Eric Feigl-Ding. He's a PhD epidemiologist at Harvard University. About as qualified as you can get to talk about this stuff. And I hope you were listening. So, all right, it's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. By the way, Dr. Ding on the web at DRERICDING. That's Dr. Eric Ding. So at Dr. Eric Ding on Twitter, best place to get a hold of him. If you don't remember that, just go to my front page there at MikeHagan.com and you can connect directly to him from my site. Okay. Anyway, very interesting and sobering, I think, information. So, all right, let's listen to.